As we stated in our lesson this morning, our worldview determines the answers to the most basic questions in life. And as I said this morning, I want to consider two of those questions tonight. Who am I? And from where did I come? These questions are answered variously by different worldviews. One of these worldviews is atheism, which most of the time works hand in hand with another worldview known as naturalism. The first one, atheism, speaks to a lack of belief in God, and the second says that all that exists is nature. That is, only what we can see, touch, taste, hear, and smell exists. If you can't touch it, taste it, hear it, smell it, or see it, it doesn't exist. So therefore, the naturalist is anti-supernatural. So first, I want to look at how these worldviews would answer these questions. Who am I? And from where did I come? According to atheism, human beings are simply complex machines, and personality is an interrelation of chemical and physical properties that we do not yet fully understand. One man put it bluntly by saying this: "Let us conclude boldly then that man is a machine, and that in the whole universe there is but a single substance with various modifications." And William Barrett writes, "Thus we get those quaint illustrations of the human body as a system of imaginary gears, cogs, and ratchets. Man, the microcosm, is just another machine within the universal machine that is the cosmos." We smile at these illustrations as quaint and crude, but secretly we may still nourish the notion that they are, after all, in the right direction, though a little premature. With the advent of the computer, however, this temptation toward mechanism becomes more irresistible, for here we no longer have an obsolete machine of wheels and pulleys, but one that seems able to reproduce the processes of the human mind. Can machines think? That question now becomes a leading question for our time, he says. He continues and says, "In any case, the point is that as human beings, we are simply a part of the cosmos. In the cosmos, there is one substance, and that is matter. We are that and only that." He continues and says, "The laws applying to matter apply to us. We do not transcend the universe in any way. Of course, we are very complex machines, and our mechanism is not yet fully understood. Thus, people continue to amaze us and upset our expectations. Still, any mystery that surrounds our understanding is a result not of genuine mystery, but of mechanical complexity." It might be concluded, he says, that humanity is not distinct from other objects in the universe, that it is merely one kind of object among many. Now, naturalists will differ from that and insist this is not so. Julian Huxley, for example, says, "We are unique among animals because we alone are capable of conceptual thought, employ speech, possess a cumulative tradition, which is culture, and have had a unique method of evolution. To this, most naturalists would add our moral capacity." So according to these worldviews, we're just glorified machines. Our complex bodies and minds came together by pure chance over billions and billions of years. But the answer of the biblical or the Christian worldview teaches that humans are created in the image of God. What does that mean? Well, first, let's consider that Jesus is the image of God. And Paul states this in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4, where he says the word, or I'm sorry, the word, he uses the word image, and that means that which has the same form as something else. Another source has this. He says the phrase stresses the equality of the image with the original. Christ in the form of God and equal to God, Philippians 2:6. The words beloved son in Colossians 1:13 drives home the point. The phrase comes, of course, from Genesis 1:27. But Christ is the second Adam, 1 Corinthians 15:45 and following. The point for Paul is that Christ is given to us as God's image so that we may know what God wills and what God does. The concept of the image of God also makes it perfectly plain who Jesus himself is. Then, as we noted this morning in Bible class, in John 1:1, we read these words. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Then in verse 14, John tells us that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. And finally, in verse 18, we are told, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. You know, the word translated explained is the word from which we get our word to exegete. This means simply to expound on or to interpret a text, especially the scriptures. So Christ has interpreted God for us. He has set forth God in great detail. Next, Paul writes in Philippians 2, 5 and 6, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be held on to. So Christ, while in heaven, was on an equal footing with God the Father. Then in Hebrews 1, 1 through 3, we read these words. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. The word translated exact representation is used of the die that is used to impress the image of a face on a coin, such as the president's faces on the coins that we use. That is, the die makes the exact same image on the coin that has been carved into the die. So the idea is that when we look at Jesus, we see God. This is exactly what Jesus said in John 14, 8 and 9. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father and it is enough for us. Jesus said to him, have I been so long with you, Philip, or with you, and yet you have not known, come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. So how can you say, show us the Father? But while Jesus is the image of God, it is said in Scripture that we are created in the image of God. Genesis 1 and verse 26. Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. What does this mean? Well, God doesn't have a physical body like ours, does he? No, John 4, 24 says God is spirit. Luke 24, 39 tells us that a spirit does not have flesh and bones. Therefore, it must be our soul or our spirit that is in God's image. This is what enables us to comprehend abstract concepts such as life, death, eternity, things of beauty. It enables us to have a moral sense of ought, of right and wrong, good and evil. You know, the fact that we're created in the image of God makes us so much more than animals. In Psalm 8, verses 3 through 8, it says this: "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea." So it is our very being that is created in God's image. It is over our spirit that we have a great deal of control. You know, the body is mostly the result of genetics. We might be able to change a little through exercise or plastic surgery. The soul, however, is different. The soul is different. Despite one's genetics, there is much that can be changed. With God's help, we can change our attitudes and character, taking on His attitude and His character that we talked about this morning. We even use the next passage we have here, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. "I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." We can prove the good and acceptable and perfect will of God by bringing our mind in correlation with His. In Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 through 15, it says, "So as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body, and be thankful." And as we said in the previous lesson, we can and must bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. But finally on this point, Solomon had this to say in Proverbs 16:32. "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city." So in answer to our question, who am I and from where did I come? We've seen that we are not a machine. We are not the result of billions and billions of years of trial and error. We have seen that we are created in the image of God. We are a soul that was created by God. In fact, it could be said this way: we are a soul that has been given a body. We are not a body that has been given a soul. Again, this body will grow old and decay, as we've been reminded very well lately. But our soul, our spirit, will live on in eternity. Given these things, let's ask one of the same questions that we asked this morning. Why does it matter? Why does it matter that we're created in the image of God? What does it mean Why does it matter that we must grasp this and understand it with the very core of our being? First, because we are created in the image of God, we have intrinsic value. Not only as an individual, but as a human life. If we have intrinsic value, then, and I'm the biggest sinner here on this one, why are we always thinking negative thoughts within and about ourselves? Telling ourselves we just aren't worth anything. We matter to God. And we should matter to ourselves. In fact, I have a niece who a couple of years ago basically wrote on Facebook, "I am nothing." And I responded to her words that I need to listen to myself. You were created in the image of God. You matter to God. You must matter to yourself. When we realize and appreciate that fact, we will have another weapon in our defense against Satan and his temptations. Next, we also have intrinsic value as a human life. You see, it has to do with human dignity. Every life matters. The whole and the broken, the young and the aged, the unborn and the ones that were not born due to miscarriage, they matter. The physically handicapped and the mentally handicapped. But instead of human dignity and the fact that every life matters, we have doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia. And that's not talking about young people in Asia. Literally, it means from the Greek, good death. As if we can relieve them of their pain and just make them, let them just pass on and not have to suffer. We want to make it good for them. You know, that has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Because I certainly don't want my loved ones to suffer. And I don't want to suffer. But if you use that argument and you agree with that, then what's the next step? The next step is the ones who are in bed, not necessarily suffering, but using up precious resources to keep them alive, and time and effort, people to take care of them, and if you make it to where the family are the only ones who can decide, then doctors will sometimes take privileges. And just go ahead and get rid of them. You don't believe that would happen? Just look to Europe. It's happening right now. In Holland, they passed the Right to Die Act of some kind. And now doctors, nurses are making the decisions for families and for aged folks. So doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia, abortion, infanticide, exposure. You say, well, what in the world is that? Well, this was done in ancient times by different societies where a child was left out in the elements to die. One letter that we have from a man to his wife said, "If the child is a boy, keep it. But if it is a girl, expose it." He said, what a barbaric practice. Why, our society would never do such a thing as that, when in fact we do. The fact is that it is still being practiced in the United States of America. If a child does not die as a result of an abortion, the nurse in the abortion clinic or in the hospital will take that child into a soundproof room, close the doors, lay them on a metal table, close the doors so they don't have to hear the child crying as it dies, with no help whatsoever. And this does not just include those who are children of failed abortions, but it includes the disabled. A child is born with spina bifida, and the parents do not want to take care of that child. They will take them into that room and leave them on that cold metal table and close those doors. You know, we spoke this morning about the expansion of abortion laws in New York. Again, as we said, thankfully there are other states like Georgia and Tennessee who have passed the fetal heartbeat bill, which states that a child cannot be aborted after 6 weeks or whenever a heartbeat has been detected. I don't believe that goes far enough, but it is much further than we have gotten in many years. Governor Kemp in Georgia has until May 12 to sign it. This is why it's so important that we become involved in these matters. Because if Georgia citizens will just pick up the phone and call the governor's mansion or Capitol Hill or whatever they call it over there and just say, "I want Governor Kemp to sign that bill." If they get more calls on that side of the issue than they do on the other, then it might have an influence. There's also in vitro fertilization, where many eggs of the woman are fertilized with the man's seed and two or three are chosen for implantation. That's all well and good. That's great. I thank God that we have this technology to help couples who are having trouble conceiving children. But usually they'll fertilize 10, 15, 20 eggs. And what do they do with those 17 that are not chosen? They wash them down the drain. You see, in Psalm 51:5, David said, "My mother conceived me." In Song of Solomon 3:4, the bride speaks of the fact that her mother conceived me. She didn't conceive an embryo. She didn't conceive a blob of tissue. She conceived a person that had identity even as a one-celled creature that began to divide. At the moment of conception, we are distinct human individuals and we have human dignity. They had identities that were separate from the mother. And the same is true even if the conception happens in a petri dish. Further, being created in the image of God and having human dignity implies something else. When Adam was created, God said, "It is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." So God created the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, and Adam was given the task to name the animals in Genesis 2:20. And there we are told that for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. Well, let's just stop here for a moment. If God is all-knowing, then why does it look like God is kind of caught off guard in this respect? He says, it's not good for man to be alone. So he creates animals and birds. And then, oh no, there aren't any animals that are suitable to be a companion to Adam. Now I got to come up with a new plan. We know that's not what happened. We know that God knew all along that he was going to create the woman for the man. So why are we given this information? Let me offer a possibility. I would surmise that God had Adam go through this exercise to let him and us see that there are no animals equal to man or suitable to man for a companion. And in fact, man is to be over the animals. So while it is said that dog is man's best friend, God said your wife is supposed to be your best friend. You see, the fact that man names the animals indicates that he had authority over them. You see, naming in the ancient Near East shows authority over the thing named. But God found no helper suitable for the man. In addition to that, as we've already said, in Genesis 1:26, mankind is given some responsibilities. We are to rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. We're to rule over those things, not to worship them, not to make them equal with humans. God gave humankind dominion over the animals. However, today it seems that animals are being placed by some on the level with humans. My mother is a tax preparer. And several years ago, she got news from about a new tax bill that was going through. And as a part of that tax bill, I don't know whether it made it all the way through the process or not, or whether it got cut out, but as a part of that tax bill, there was a line that made it where pet owners could be able to deduct the expenses they have on their pets, like vet bills and so forth and so on. You know, kind of like counting a child as a deduction. Well, she was in the office one day, my mother, and she went out front to where the secretaries are, and she made mention of this proposal, and she said something to the effect that it was getting to where parents would be loving their pets more than their children. Then one of the ladies spoke up and said, "I love my dog more than I do my children." You see, the humanization of animals, when that happens, you're not raising animals up, you're bringing humans down. It The humanization of animals only results in the dehumanization of humans. For example, in the magazine called Simply Sierra, which is published by the Sierra Club, an article was written about a man in the Northeast who studies black bears and has done so for decades. The article says this: bears are quite social. They have a society of sorts, a matriarchy. They use a rich system of communication. They're highly self-aware, and perhaps most surprising, they are governed by long-term relationships and rules of conduct. The one who studies them thinks that these dynamics reflect and, across evolutionary lines, have shaped black bear intelligence, an intelligence comparable to that of chimpanzees and other great apes and sharing many properties with our own. They're like us, he says. They judge. They punish. They have gratitude and friendship. The article also mentions the fact that when a black bear in upstate New York started opening the latest in bear-proof canisters, other local bears soon followed suit. Then the question is asked, did she teach them? Now, there's no question that animals have feelings and often show intelligence beyond what we would think they would have, such as the dog, which was trained to open the refrigerator and to retrieve a beverage for its owner. And we know that young animals learn by emulating their mothers, and animals can be trained to even use sign language. But this is a far cry from animals thinking like humans. You see, the animal cannot decide one day that it wants to learn about sign language, go over to a shelf and retrieve a book and say, let me see what I can learn, start learning sign language. The modern movement to humanize animals is based on a belief that the only way to assure the ongoing survival of animals is to say that animals are not that much different from humans. In fact, some have gone so far as to say that if man would simply cease to exist, the earth would be much better off. In other words, humankind is a hindrance to the proper function of the earth. But they ignore the fact that the earth was created for man. And as we saw, man was given dominion over the earth and all that is in it. Now, that doesn't mean that we can waste our resources. It doesn't mean that we can pollute our resources. It does mean that we should use them wisely. Well, in this lesson, we have answered the questions, who am I and from where did I come? We learned that mankind was created by God and thus came from God. And that has implications. But there's one final point I want to make. It matters that we realize that we have a soul that is created in the image of God, because in realizing that, we must also recognize that our soul is immortal and will live in eternity. Eternity has no end. Therefore, we must be prepared to enter into it. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation, I beg you to come now as we stand and sing.